Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeely reporting. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un plans to invite experts and journalists from Seoul and the United States to observe when North Korea shuts down its nuclear test site in May. South Korean Presidential Press Secretary Yoon Young-chan also quoted Kim as saying that the United States, though inherently hostile to North Korea, will get to know our talk begins, that I am not the kind of person who will use nuclear weapons against the South or the United States across the Pacific. Still, National Security Advisor John Bolton on news program Fox News Sunday says no one in the administration is getting starry-eyed about a deal with North Korea.
We've heard similar things from North Korea before. That's why I think that while we should be optimistic in pursuing the opportunity, we should be skeptical of rhetoric until we see some concrete evidence.
U.S. President Donald Trump said at a White House news conference with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, "I don't think he's playing," when asked about the historic summit between North and South Korea. Trump said it's up to three possible sites that are being considered for a much-anticipated summit. After making his diplomatic debut in Brussels at the NATO foreign ministers' meeting, new U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in Saudi Arabia on the first stop of a swing through the Middle East. His senior policy advisor, Brian Hook, who's accompanying Pompeo, called on European allies and other countries to impose sanctions on Iran to weaken its missile program. The three-day trip, during which he is expected to brief U.S. allies on administration policy towards Iran, also includes stops in Israel and Jordan. Friday, Pompeo said no decision has been made on whether President Trump will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump has threatened to shut down the government later this year if Congress does not approve enough funding for border security, including money to build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. Last month, Mr. Trump signed a $1.3 trillion spending bill that keeps the government open until the end of September. Speaking at a campaign rally Saturday in Washington Township, Michigan, the president said the congressional spending bill vote would come up again on September 28th, but if it does not include money for the wall, he will not sign the bill. Fighting in northern Myanmar between government forces and a rebel independence army, or KIA, has forced more than 4,000 people to leave their homes. Aid organizations have requested access to the clash-stricken remote northeastern area near the country's border with China. Charities fear thousands of vulnerable people remain trapped since the fighting escalated in April. UK ambassador to the UN Karen Pierce says the Myanmar government should participate in talks to solve this crisis.
It may take some time, but we would like to hear from the government of Myanmar how it wishes to work with the international community, and we will do everything we can as the Security Council to support progress and trying to come together to take decisions that help the Rohingya.
Rohingyas in Myanmar have been denied citizenship, even though many of their families have lived in Myanmar for generations. Israel has abandoned a plan to deport thousands of African migrants, Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
About 37,000 African migrants have gotten a reprieve after Israel canceled deportation orders that had left the community in limbo. In February, the government handed out papers to thousands of African males, which amounted to an ultimatum: leave the country in 2 months or go to prison. The plan was abandoned when Rwanda backed out of a deal to take the migrants in, saying it could not guarantee their safety. In a radio interview, Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan admitted that the government has no solution for the problem of the infiltrators, as they are called here. He blamed Israel's Supreme Court and human rights groups, which warned that forcibly deporting the migrants back to Africa would endanger their lives. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
A floating nuclear power plant built in Russia has embarked on its first sea voyage so its reactors can be loaded with fuel. The floating plant was towed Saturday out of St. Petersburg shipyard where it was constructed. It is to be pulled through the Baltic Sea and around the northern tip of Norway and northwest Russia where the nuclear reactors are to be fueled. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
These major U.S. multinational corporations that are based in the U.S., they have a presence in Nigeria, even if the oil they're producing there is being shipped elsewhere.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari plans to meet U.S. President Donald J. Trump Monday.
Madam Sirleaf took over a difficult country. She took over a country that had just ended war.
Former Liberian President Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf accepts the Mo Ibrahim Prize for Achievement in African Leadership.
Lungot was behind the President Lungu. Then, according to whispers in the rumor mill, he failed to get a position or a job.
And the Zambian opposition leader challenges President Edgar Lungu's citizenship. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has arrived in the U.S. ahead of his meeting with President Donald Trump, scheduled for Monday at the White House. According to officials, the two leaders are expected to focus on fighting terrorism and insecurity, economic growth, and democratic development in Nigeria. The meeting would make President Buhari the first African president to meet Donald Trump this year at the White House. For more, Shehu Garba, spokesman for the Nigerian president, joins me live via telephone link up. Good afternoon, Shehu.
Good afternoon, and how are you?
I'm well, thank you. So, Shehu, how is Mr. President following his long trip to Washington this morning?
Well, he has arrived, as you said, very safely, and he's been accommodated at the famous Blair House and had a short meeting with the officials, all of us, and then retired to have some rest.
So what are his expectations for Monday's meeting with President Trump at the White House?
Well, it's really a very high-profile meeting. From the assemblage of officials put around the table for tomorrow's meeting, I think that all the teams have made their agenda very clear. As we said in the introductory part, terrorism and insecurity is going to be a key part. The issue of economic growth and democratic development in Nigeria. These are matters that would be discussed, and we expect that the level of cooperation, which has substantially improved under President Donald Trump, would be further enhanced following this meeting.
Now, Shehu, what would you say has been the relationship between Washington and Abuja, particularly following the election of President Donald Trump here in America?
Well, you know that this can be underscored by recalling a statement which President Buhari once made. Out of frustration, considering the havoc that the Boko Haram terrorism was causing not only to Nigeria, but to the entire Lake Chad, and we are inhibited in many ways from getting training and acquiring weapons to effectively fight Boko Haram on account, not arising from wickedness on the part of the previous Obama administration, but on account of a Leahy law, which formed the basis of refusal to sell equipment to us, an allegation that human rights had been abused. Not that this is not important. We are quite pleased that, President Trump has brushed all that aside. And he has given approval for resumption of the sale of military equipment and training to Nigeria. This is very important as a mark of cooperation between our two countries.
Now, Shehu, previously there were reports of disagreement of what help the U.S. Military can give to the Nigerian military in the fight against Boko Haram. What will the president seek tomorrow, and what are your expectations of the help that you will need in the fight against terrorism and particularly Boko Haram militants in Nigeria and across the borders?
Well, you know, for instance, I just mentioned this sale of military equipment, the Super Tucano aircraft, 12 of which, President Trump has approved for Nigeria. These are special surveillance and attack, aircraft, which we need immediately. my sense is we probably would seek an urgent delivery. Yes, according to the contract, maybe they would be delivered by 2020. Possibly, if we are lucky, one or two might be delivered if the president, our president, succeeds in persuading the American, you know, government to do that. On the overall, you know that, as I said, the cooperation has improved, but we think that these things are not moving as fast as we want. And in addition to that, of course, you have also, you know, the humanitarian situation, which is massive. Over 20 million people removed, you know, from their homes and towns and communities. We expect that the American government would, through the USAID, pay more attention, you know, to this situation in the northeast of Nigeria.
What is the current situation of the fight against Boko Haram by the Nigerian military so far, if I may ask you, Shehu?
The military, as far as they are concerned, they have accomplished the major objective, which is the defeat of the Boko Haram, a recovery of territory and all of that. However, you know that the war had entered a new gear, which is of the urban warfare type. Boko Haram now has resorted to the use of little girls and boys in order to penetrate the places of worship, churches and mosques, upon whom, you know, they tie up bombs which explode, you know, in places that are like that, including the markets and the motor parks. So there is a need for more intelligence gathering, and we believe that the United States and their European allies, their enhanced intelligence capabilities, would certainly also be doing more to assist Nigeria so that we can do better in detection of the movements of some of these you know, human beings who are carrying explosives.
Now, Shehu, President Buhari recently announced his re-election bid. Some of his supporters believe he will be given the mandate, a second mandate by the people of Nigeria. Others are saying he has failed to keep his promises of improving security and the living conditions of Nigerians. What do you think, realistically, are his chances or the prospect of winning re-election?
Well, the chances are excellent, because President Buhari, contrary to what the opposition is saying, has done exceedingly well in combating Boko Haram. He has pushed back Boko Haram. Boko Haram was present. You know, they had bombed the UN headquarters in Abuja. They had reached the southern states of Edo and even Lagos. So the fact that they are now confined to the fringes of Lake Chad. And again, this must also be due to the fact that our neighbors are doing extremely well supporting our work. But you cannot compare their strength in terms of security with what we have in Nigeria. So there's some penetration across border, which we are working together in the, you know, in the Lake Chad region to see how this can be combated. The economic situation, welfare situation of Nigeria would get better. The thing is that we had to hit the bottom to start coming up. And this happened because of the rottenness of the economy that we had inherited. The economy was awful and driven largely by oil revenues. Oil had a big, big fall in the international market. This wasn't due to President Buhari. Rather, President Buhari did a lot, in fact, to rally the troops together, the oil producers, you know, to restrict outflow and to get better prices. And things are picking up now. Our economy is doing well. Investment is hugely coming. And the welfare of Nigerians will continue to get attention of the government. So yes, President Buhari is doing well. It's not the time to change the president. Certainly not.
Now, Shehu, some people are saying the president has failed in the fight against corruption because when he got into power, there were all these reports of previous administration officials who have allegedly embezzled public purse money and all that stuff, and that so far none of them have been prosecuted to the full extent of the law. That is why they are accusing the president of failing to fight corruption as we see it in Nigeria. How do you respond to that?
No, it is not true to say that there have not been high-profile prosecutions. So many people are there, including sitting senators, former governors, former ministers, and all of that. Nigeria's constitution, as you have in the United States of America, is a complex one. Strong division of powers. The president can only investigate using agencies under him and bring these matters before judges. The courts have absolute freedom to determine cases, and the president cannot dictate to them. So we're not blaming courts. Under the new leadership of the judiciary in the country, I think they are coming around to the fact that they too need to be part of the war against corruption. But are we getting as much international support that we need? I think this is why this meeting again tomorrow with President Trump is important. We have money stolen from Nigeria that is locked up in America. All efforts to bring back this money are proving to be very difficult. We want our money back. These are the things that we'll use so that we change the lives of Nigerians, and they will appreciate that they are gains coming from the war against corruption.
Now, Shehu, recently your administration came up with a list of looters, as described by the government. People are questioning the timing of the release, saying that the government had this information all along. Why bring it up when the president was about to announce his re-election bid? They think, the critics, that is, say that this is a ploy to hoodwink Nigerians into, you know, giving President Buhari yet another term. How do you respond to that?
No, you know what happened was that actually all this while, the president had resisted the pressure to expose the people on account of this issue. Why was he doing that? It is because a number of them had voluntarily cooperated with the government of Nigeria, and they had reached terms of settlement by which money was being brought back. For President Muhammadu Buhari, look, the most important thing, yes, there is need to penalize people for corruption, but we need our money back, and that's what we will use in order to make life better for Nigeria. So the people who have operated very well and return money, you don't have to scandalize them. But the party, the opposition party, the PDP, came under a new leadership, very noisy leadership, that had harassed everyone around, asking that, look, you people have lied, you have collected back nothing, there is nobody who is being this. There are no corrupt people in Nigeria. These are the lies they keep telling. If there are people who are under investigation, there are corrupt people, bring out their names. Bring out their names. And when the pressure got too much, the government of Nigeria now published this name. I'm sure to their embarrassment that the top-level leader, even of the new PDP that they're saying they have, is embedded in corruption. So if they have burnt their hands over this matter, they should blame no one but themselves. They shouldn't blame President Buhari.
Before we leave, Shehu, there were reports of impeachment proceedings. Some are calling for the president to be impeached. Some are calling on him to resign because of insecurity concerns and all that. Briefly, what do you make of it?
It will amount to nothing. It can't succeed. And what is the issue? Is it because the president of Nigeria has rushed payment in order to procure needed military hardware to protect the country? Is that why they should? Anybody would think about that? I hope that you read reports of the fact that even the guy who tabled the issue of impeachment in the Senate has recanted. And he's begging his way around saying that, no, he was misled. So please, forget about that. The president is comfortable. He's not under any pressure whatsoever on this matter. And whatever differences are there between executive and legislative arms of government will be resolved. And we get on with governance.
Thank you very much, Shehu. That was Shehu Garba, a spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, Monday's summit between Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari and U.S. President Donald Trump comes at a difficult moment in bilateral relations. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with two experts on why Trump may have issued the invitation now.
When the White House meeting was announced, many Africa experts, including John Campbell, doubted that it would accomplish much, given recent history. Campbell is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria.
There was the unfortunate characterization of Africa and certain Caribbean states made by the president a couple of months ago that caused a good deal of pain in Africa, and that pain has not altogether dissipated. So, from an African perspective, I would have said that the administration does not appear to be particularly friendly.
Or, from Campbell's perspective, particularly well prepared. He points out that several top diplomatic posts to Africa remain open, including the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs.
What I cannot tell you, because I literally have no idea, is what the White House's agenda is.
The White House says the visit is intended to further the two countries' shared interests, including economic growth and reforms. Campbell is dubious. American exporters once hoped to tap into the Nigerian market, now nearly 200 million people strong. But today, says Campbell, most Nigerians live on less than $2 a day.
That means most Nigerians literally do not have discretionary income to spend on things like shampoo or razor blades.
America used to import 1 million barrels of Nigerian oil a day. Now we import none. West Africa historian Gregory Mann of New York's Columbia University says that doesn't mean that U.S. business interests in Nigeria have dried up.
These major U.S. multinational corporations that are based in the U.S., they have a presence in Nigeria, even if the oil they're producing there is being shipped elsewhere.
Security and the fight against terrorism are certain to be high on the agenda Monday. Boko Haram is still active in Nigeria. However, Campbell says alleged human rights abuses by Nigeria's security forces provide a complication. He cites an American law which requires the suspension of U.S. military assistance to any nation whose security forces are credibly accused of such abuses until the charges have been investigated and resolved. President Barack Obama halted the delivery of several military planes to Nigeria after the government bombed a Nigerian refugee camp. Campbell pointed out that, in contrast, the Trump administration and the U.S. Congress recently approved the sale of some relatively light military aircraft to Buhari's government. According to Gregory Mann, that sale was consistent with Trump's emphasis on military force over diplomacy. And given that a huge number of the State Department's Africa experts have quit or been fired...
There's no referee. All this depends on desk officers doing their work. If there's nobody to say, well, these are the things you must take into account, then the law is not worth the paper that it's written on.
In the view of Ambassador John Campbell and others, there is an intimate relationship between a respect for humanitarian concerns, including human rights, and national security. So it's up to Trump and Buhari to negotiate that balance. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Former Liberian President Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has accepted the Mo Ibrahim Prize for Achievement in African Leadership. The prize is given to a democratically elected African leader who has demonstrated exceptional leadership, served their mandated terms, and left office within the previous 3 years. The award comes with $5 million, which is paid over 10 years, and $200,000 annually for life for the winner. For reaction in Liberia following the award, I reached Leonard Dodu, the front page African newspaper news desk chief in the Liberian capital, Monrovia.
Well, Peter, actually, a lot of Liberians are not celebrating this award. It's not even been talked about much. Maybe it could be because of the time that she was pronounced the winner of the award, and also the time that it's been given. Maybe most of them have forgotten about it. But generally, when she was named the winner of the prize, a lot of Liberians here at home was saying that she does not deserve it because, even though she has that international recognition, locally Liberians don't really recognize or show the level of appreciation for the work that she has done. They believe that she could have done better and that she didn't do much for the country.
Now, she dedicated the award to women empowerment. Does that mean that women in Liberia, didn't really feel her leadership role in empowering them. Is that a reflection on the ground?
The truth of the matter is that Madam Johnson Sirleaf did empower women in Liberia. Her government had a lot of women, you know, compared to previous governments that that led before her. She did a lot to help the Liberian women. She did a lot to stop domestic violence against women. And even before she left power, she did sign the FGM bill that was dangling at the legislature for years. And I mean, through an executive order, for at least for 1 year, she banned FGM. That was the best she could do, you know, before she left. And I mean, it is true that Madam Sirleaf has done a lot to help women, and she did dedicate a lot of her initiatives towards empowering women.
Madam Sirleaf's critics are saying that she should have done more, and that is why she appears not to be popular in Liberia. As somebody who resides in the capital and knows Liberia, is this assertion true?
It is true in a way. A lot of people had expected Madam Sirleaf to have fought corruption, which she didn't achieve much on. I mean, she admitted to failing on the fight against corruption. Currently, as we speak, one of her sons, Robert A. Sirleaf, was named in a recent Global Witness report for allegedly receiving bribes to award an oil block. I mean, that case is under investigation right now. That's even the first instance in which, I mean, he has been accused of acts of corruption. Madam Sirleaf, a lot of Liberians expected her to have improved the life of the ordinary Liberians, but there was no major improvement. I mean, the poor remained poor, and the rich kept getting richer. They feel that she didn't do much for the ordinary Liberians, and therefore they really cannot understand why she's so much celebrated internationally when the essence of her leadership is not really being felt at the local level.
Now, Leonard, the Prize Committee admitted that while Sirleaf was accused of tolerating corruption, she had shown exceptional leadership in difficult circumstances, adding that Liberia was only one country out of 54 to improve in every category and subcategory of the Ibrahim Index of African Governance. How do you respond to that?
You know, Madam Sirleaf took over a difficult country. She took over a country that had just ended war. And, I mean, all our institutions were totally down. She did her best in resuscitating some of these institutions, putting policies in place. I mean, she did a lot of paperwork. Unfortunately, the positive effects of these policies, maybe her regime was too short for it to begin to trigger down to the ordinary Liberians to have a feel of the positive effects of these, you know, policies that she put in place. But nonetheless, I mean, there were instances where people had expected her to act in a more decisive manner that she didn't. There were instances where we had expected her to, you know, take certain actions in the interest of Liberians, and we didn't see it coming. People feel that Madam Sirleaf had a lot of international support for the country to have been left, you know, for the coffers of the national coffers to have been left broke. I mean, on the overall, the ordinary Liberians, I mean, those, the market woman, did not really feel the impact of Madam Sirleaf's regime in terms of improving lives. That's what ordinary Liberians look out for, improve their living conditions, and that actually wasn't felt.
Leonard Dodu is the Front Page African newspaper news desk chief. He spoke with me from Monrovia.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, there is growing debate about the citizenship of Zambian President Edgar Lungu. This after an opposition leader said he has evidence to prove that the president is not a Zambian citizen. Mike Mulongoti, leader of the opposition People's Party, says he has taken steps to establish the truth about the controversy surrounding the president's citizenship. But supporters of the president rejected the accusation, saying this is yet another attempt by an opposition leader to tarnish the reputation of the president. To learn more about the controversy regarding the Zambian president's citizenship, I reached Caesar Sendeli, programs manager at Pan-African Radio in the capital, Lusaka.
That debate is ongoing. It was started by Mike Mulongoti, who is the leader of the party called the People's Party. He's a former minister in the former ruling party, the MMD. And the information he's giving the people, it has been received with mixed feelings. Many people still believe he's not telling the truth, because President Edgar Lungu would have been known to be a foreigner by the time he was a member of parliament or minister, because that time no one questioned his nationality. So people are wondering, where is he getting the information? And today we just saw his sister has come out also in the open to say, he's my young brother and we've grown up together, we've lived in different places, and they underwent a lot of hardships as a family because the father was a casual worker, you know, working for the railway company.
Caesar, Mr. Mulongoti, the former information minister, claimed that he has empirical proof of President Edgar Lungu not being a Zambian. Some critics are saying, why isn't he going to court to present his proof to challenge President Lungu's citizenship?
Yes, you know, he has already written to the public protector about it. So he's obviously waiting the response from the public protector. And if there'll be guidance that the matter be taken to court, it has to come from the public protector. So meantime, he's just going on with his allegations that President Lungu is a foreigner.
But how are people reacting to this? What is the significance of this? And what does he aim to achieve with this move?
Some people are saying at some point, which is very vivid, he campaigned for President Lungu in 2015, when he was just aspiring to become president in 2015, after the death of President Michael Sata. So Mr. Mulongoti was behind President Lungu. Then, according to whispers in the rumor mill, he failed to get a position or a job in President Lungu's government. So some people are saying he's just disappointed. So he's coming up with those claims. And then the people in Zambia, it's not everyone who is receiving it with saying it's welcome, it's a truth. Those in the opposition, of course, some of them they're going for it, they're saying it's true. Because obviously, you know, as opposition, they are also fighting against his leadership. So perhaps people that are accepting that information to be true could be that are people in the opposition.
Some of the opposition parties have accused President Lungu of dictatorship, of suppressing the press, of unleashing violence by his supporters on them. Is this a true reflection of what is going on in Zambia?
Well, Peter, as you know, Zambia has always been known to be a beacon of peace, and there's always peace and tranquility prevailing in the country. Even as now, as I speak to you, Zambia is intact in terms of governance. There is a government in place. The opposition are playing their checks and balances without much ado. But I know there are those that could be being found wanting. Obviously, those that could be found wanting, they have broken the law. What does the law say? They have to face the long arm of the law. And of course, those people that are being penalized or being taken to prisons or what, are those that could be maybe breaking the law. Issues to do with a dictatorship. Yeah, those things are coming up, but they are not coming from the general citizenry. It's a section of society.
Saturday was the 94th birthday of the founding president of Zambia, Dr. Kenneth Kaunda. How did the people take it? And I understand President Lungu and his cabinet went there to celebrate with the former president.
Yes, it was very overwhelming. You know, we are one of the few countries in the world that have the first president still living. You know, it was a very awesome event whereby, you know, the president himself, President Edgar Lungu, and cabinet ministers and the diplomatic corps, you know, paid a courtesy call on President Kaunda at his residence. And, of course, the other members of the general public also had to find time, organizations had to find time to go and just commend this man and for liberating Zambia in 1964. You know, he sacrificed a lot. He had a very instrumental role in liberating our country from colonialism. And so we are happy as a nation, and people in Zambia are all happy. And messages of goodwill have flooded social media, Facebook, from all Zambians, or almost all Zambians are just still sending messages to Dr. Kaunda, wishing him all the best.
Cesar Sendele is the program's manager at Pan-African Radio in Zambia. He spoke with me from Lusaka. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football news. The president of the Confederation of African Football, CAF, Ahmed Ahmed, has congratulated Egyptian footballer Mohamed Salah following the Liverpool's forward declaration as Professional Footballers Association PFA Player of the Year for the 2017-2018 season. In a statement posted on CAF website, Ahmed said, in his words, "Salah has really made Africa proud," adding that as the reigning African Player of the Year, Salah has proven that African players have the ability to rub shoulders with the best in the world. The African footballer family is proud, he added, of Salah's achievement as a true son of the soil. The 25-year-old Salah is the first Egyptian and first African-born player to win the PFA honor. Meanwhile, on a sad note, French soccer tactician Henri Michel, who trained several African teams, died last week. The French Footballers Union announced on Tuesday that Michel died aged 70. His long career in Africa saw him coach Morocco, Cameroon, Tunisia, Côte d'Ivoire, Equatorial Guinea, and Kenya. It was his time with Morocco from 1995 to 2000 that he led the Atlanta Lions to qualify for the 1998 World Cup staged in France. At club level, Michel managed Egyptian side Zamalek, South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns, and Raja Casablanca of Morocco for two terms. He managed France between 1984 and 1988, taking over after a French team containing Michel Platini won the European Championships under Michel Hidalgo. And in rugby, Kenya Sevens collected 10 points from Singapore Sevens after finishing their campaign with a 17-7 loss to New Zealand in the fifth place semi-final at the National Stadium on Sunday. Kurt Baker scored his 101 series try to get the All Blacks going, with Willie Ambaka unable to get the top tackle, and Hidule converted for a 7-0 lead. However, Shuja hit back immediately as Dan Shukuta showed a real determination, race clear, and Eden Agero converted to even the scores. Next on the series for Kenya Sevens is London and Paris Sevens in May before they head to USA for the World Cup in July. Earlier, the Kenyans lost 24-12 to South Africa in the main cup quarters. Finally, in tennis, world number one Rafael Nadal defeated David Goffin 6-4, 6-0 to reach the Barcelona final. Nadal has played just 9 matches since retiring from his quarterfinal match at the 2018 Australian Open with a leg injury. But already he had reached several milestones. He kicked off last week with his 11th Monte Carlo title and his 31st ATP Masters Trophy. Nadal is now one win away from a record 11th crown with his defeat of David Goffin on Saturday. On Sunday, Nadal plays 19-year-old Stefanos Tsitsipas in the final. Tsitsipas is the first Greek to reach an ATP World Tour final in 45 years. And that's it for this edition of Netline Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Netline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Yeah.
Adidu Epo Saglavi no Samoti Lazade Natero Hasta Adidu Epo Saglavi no Samoti Lazade Natero Hasta.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The death of Professor Adebayo Adedeji of Nigeria in Lagos last week represents the end of an era. Professor Adedeji was that rare scholar who believes in intellectual honesty. He was a thorough researcher and uses his research for policy prescription in the service of his country and Africa. he applied his research policies when he was appointed the commissioner for economic planning development in Nigeria and acquitted himself extremely well. But he was also a passionate believer in African regional integration. He was able to articulate the vision for regional integration in West Africa and championed the creation of ECOWAS in 1975. Later on, he helped in the formulation in East Africa of COMESA, and then later on in also 1983, the ECAS in Central Africa. Professor Adebeji was appointed the head of the Economic Commission of Africa in 1975 and became an international civil servant at a time when the United Nations Independent Civil Service was less political and characterized by high professional achievement and integrity. He endeavored to put the ECA in a very strong position as a research institution of global recognition. He surrounded himself with competent African economists, and the team was able to energize policy prescriptions for Africa. While he was in ECA, Professor Adedeji dealt with some of the major international problems. For example, he spearheaded the intellectual challenge to the Bretton Woods Institution's neoliberal policy prescriptions towards Africa by articulating the African Alternative Framework to structural adjustment programs for socio-economic reconstruction and transformation. This was not an easy task and not a popular task, but because of his intellectual strength, he managed to prevail, and later many economists globally recognized that his formulations were the correct ones. Professor Adedeji has a very restless mind, and he tried to use whatever he could do for Africa because he believed strongly that Africa has grown its own independent way. He became an advisor to presidents of the continent, and also, after he left the ECA, was involved with both the OAU and the African Union. He prepared many recommendations and studies for the African Union, and one would have wished the heads of state of Africa of listening to his recommendation. But Professor Adedeji was not one who bothers whether his prescriptions are followed. He believes that he should continue to articulate it. And when he retired from the United Nations in 1991, he returned to Nigeria to see what he could do for his country. He created a think tank because he understood if Africa was going to advance, it must have economists and professionals who spend time doing relevant research for their country and for their continent. Professor Adedeji will be sorely missed. He is not a man who believes in flamboyance and boastfulness. And anyone who knows him knows that he is not a toady. Luckily, he has been able to develop some very reliable disciples who are the future African economists in our age. Hopefully, these young African economists will play a major role. And surely, Professor Adedeji represents the kind of model servant that Africa sorely needs at this time. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, if while climbing a tree you insist on going beyond the top, the earth will be waiting for you. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the recent release of the State Department's annual report on human rights practices, John Sullivan, who was serving as U.S. Acting Secretary of State, pointed to Iran as one of the countries with an egregious record.
The Iranian people continue to suffer at the hands of their leaders. The right of peaceful assembly and freedoms of association and expression are the legitimate expectation of all individuals worldwide. Unfortunately, for the Iranian people, these human rights are under attack almost daily.
The State Department report noted the repression of nationwide protests in Iran that began on December 28, 2017, and the severe restrictions on religious freedom in the country, including the continued repression of the Baha'i community. The report also cited the Iranian government's disproportionate targeting of ethnic minority groups, including Kurds, Azeris, and Baluchis, for arbitrary arrest, prolonged detention, and physical abuse. Government harassment and prosecution of publishers, editors, and journalists were reported as well, in addition to restriction of access to the Internet. The report also noted that Iranian women remain subject to broad governmental discrimination in law and practice. In his preface to the report, Mr. Sullivan warned that states like Iran that violate their citizens' human rights and restrict their fundamental freedoms are forces of instability. Our foreign policy, he declared, promotes freedom as a matter of principle and interest. The United States will continue to support those around the world struggling for human dignity and liberty.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com.